If the river keep rising, water gonna overflow.
This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our own personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. The speaker tonight I met a long time ago. We got sober together, and he's awesome, and so I give you Moses.
My name is Moses.
Good evening. Good
evening. And I'm an alcoholic. And the words that I heard when I first got here, man. Sometimes, you know, we take it for granted, this, but they say it and it's read every meeting. But it took me years to memorize what they were saying. That's something that I heard every day. Rarely have we seen a person fail who thoroughly follows our path. So, if any of you thinking about doing a slip anytime soon, will you do me a favor? Come out and let me know what that beverage Smirnoff Vodka tastes like. 28 years and 10 months ago. It was a warm December night in Atlanta, Georgia. And I was at a function sponsored by the Atlanta chapter of the Grammys. And their party was in Fancy Hotel in Buckhead. And the after party was at East Lake Golf Club ballroom. So on that night, I remember like yesterday going there, and everything was flowing, everything was free, anything you want, bartender, what do you have, what do you want? So I was like, my name is on that Quavo gold there. Keep it flowing. It's been 28 years in between my last drink. And if I can make it another 6 weeks, I will have 29 years. I think I might quit drinking by then. Well, I owe a lot of people in this program a bit of gratitude and attitude for all they did to help me get on this path. And some of those people are here tonight, and Lisa, and several others, Rusty, and where did he go? Oh, he went out. But all these people are important. I was listening to Bill Wilson earlier tonight. You know, now I can appreciate the founders of this program even more today than I did back then. Because you have to stay connected, because 28 years ago, you know, until I started working with newcomers recently, a lot of this stuff I had forgotten, or you don't think about. I mean, you don't forget you're an alcoholic, but a lot of the basic stuff, if you don't use it, you won't remember it. So, and those guys, you know, fascinating to me. You know, they came from various backgrounds and different disciplines, and they all brought something to this program, and they talked about how hard it was to get this program sober and how important the newcomer was, or the suffering addict was. That's something that I don't want ever to forget. That's why I place a lot of importance on the newcomer. I was listening to a minister, and he was talking about he had opened up his parish to allow this group to come in during the off hours of the church and have AA meetings. And he said one day one of the sisters, who was a so-called high church lady, asked him, "Why do you fool around with all those drunks and addicts?" And he said to her, his response was, "Well, I think you're an addict too." And she was like, "What do you mean? I don't drink." He said, "Yeah, but you drunk off righteousness. Self-righteousness." So you might find somewhere along the way that self-righteousness can be one of our handicaps. So I'm saying that to say all these things, you know, it took these simple little steps behind me to make me see my own shortcomings. And the reason that's important, because those things caused my behavior to change. And when I first was introduced to a treatment, I remember like yesterday, the person said, "Do you think you have a problem with alcohol?" I said, "No, I don't think I have a problem with alcohol. I think I have a problem with control." And I wasn't only talking about controlling liquor. I was talking about controlling everything. You know, I had to be in charge. I was the only one capable of being in charge. So those were those hidden problems that I was dealing with. And as you see the story progress, you will see how that impacted my decisions and some of my action, what made me the person that I didn't want to be. I grew up in a little town south of Montgomery, about 50 miles from Selma, with no red lights and a few stop signs, both paved and unpaved roads. So everybody had the green light there. Whatever you wanted to do and get away with it, you could do it. So at a young age, I became fascinated with this extra curriculum stuff. But I was grounded in strong Southern Baptist roots. My mother was a fantastic piano player. My daddy was a faithful deacon. So all of my brothers and sisters, it was 10 of us. Most of us was at home at the same time, but I was the youngest boy out of 7, and I was the 9th child. So I got a chance to observe all these other people. And so a lot of my behavior was formed by some of my older siblings. So this little town was made up about, back then, maybe 1,000 people. 75% African American and 25% Caucasian. And we had 2 high schools. One was black and one was white. But after integration started, we ended up with 2 black high schools because all the white kids transferred and went to the school what was private in Monroeville, Alabama. Well, there was a couple of families that were poor white families that couldn't afford to go to these private schools. And they had to stay there and go to school with the black kids. But have you know that those guys, and they were Ricky, Joe, and his sister, they became some of my best friends. And we all played together. I'm saying that to say that, that it was a balanced, diverse community with a lot of different people and behaviors and attitudes. Like, they had some strange names in that town. Like, one guy was named Stomp Down. And Stomp Down really was on the ground. He was stomped like he was stomped down. So then there was another guy named Burnt Wilson. Well, Burnt Wilson had this buggy and a mule. And Burnt Wilson was rolling on 20s back in the 60s. So he and his mule, all they did was go up and down that road. You saw him everywhere. So it was always an interesting setting. And then there was the cafe, where a lot of things took place at the cafe. But I'm still an adolescent, so I wasn't able to participate, but I got all the gossip. So my cousin, who was my best friend, had more freedom than I had. Mama wasn't here, and me not being at home. And being, I was at church, and I was going to school, and I was going to do my work. And I was real active in the school. Everybody thought I was this great guy, which I probably was. But I figured out young how to manipulate people since everybody trusted me. So, and I was a pretty smart kid. I think I was above average smart. So I had these divided thoughts, one good, one bad. And I was able to keep the balance, you know. I didn't go overboard with the bad stuff, but I did a lot of bad. So, and I was a typical kid, but I really didn't like the taste of alcohol. And it was years before I got involved with alcohol. But our next door neighbor, they made what they call homebrew. And Uncle Bull was an incredible homebrew maker. And everybody came to his house to purchase these little jars of homebrew. But I never saw Uncle Bull drinking, so he was a pretty good businessman. He didn't drink up all his product. But he kept a line of cars going and coming. It didn't matter whether it was Monday or Sunday. It was always wide open over there with Uncle Bull. So I understood people drinking and all this partying and all this stuff was going on. So I got a chance to see it. Then, as I got a little older in high school, I started to see the impact of alcohol on some of the adults. There was this one guy named David Crockett. And David would go to work, but on the weekend, you could find David walking up the road. He'd go one step forward, two steps back. David would be in the same place that morning, he'd be in the same place that evening when he got back, David. And he'd be foaming at the mouth and singing. So we all, the kids, made fun of David and laughed at David. But little did I know, you know, the impact that alcohol had on David. He probably didn't understand that he had a mental obsession and an allergy. And he didn't know anything about what we have here. And once again, that's why I'm so grateful for this program. But David demonstrated what blackouts and all those things we hear about really mean. So that was one of my first experiences with a person that I thought couldn't control his liquor. Well, there were others that couldn't control their liquor, that drank continuously and did this on a regular basis. So I got a chance to witness all these things at a young age. So by now, I'm probably about the ninth grade, and I'm starting to get heavy in the athletics. So this kept me involved and engaged. I wanted to be a good athlete, so I was always physically prepared. So alcohol wasn't a problem yet. So then, I guess by my junior year, we would leave the South. My brother lived in Cleveland, Ohio. So we would go to Cleveland to work during the summer. And my cousins in Cleveland were all the hip guys. So they was doing things that I hadn't started to do in Alabama. They had a little marijuana and a few other things, you know, back then, but that was in the 70s, I guess. But that was a drink out, and it was long before a lot of you all call Hopping Gator. And Hopping Gator was a tricky drink. Hopping Gator was like Kool-Aid and all these other things mixed with liquor and a lot of sugar. So this sugar hid that alcohol content. So you could indulge and drink a whole lot of Hopping Gator, and the next thing you know, you'd be hopping. So that was one of, you know, my first experience with alcohol, and understanding then that I didn't like the taste of it, boy, but I sure liked the effect. So I could take, you know, Hopping Gator without any real issues. So I didn't think I was going to ever develop no habit from Hopping Gator. It's just a little Kool-Aid. So by then, this was the early 70s. Now, we had this little job, and I was an entrepreneur, and we started selling candy door to door in Shaker Heights. I mean, the houses were so big it'd take you 10 minutes to get to the front door. And you sit there and you ring the doorbell, boy, it just played for hours. Doom, 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 doom. Somebody would finally show up. And we were selling these boxes of thin mints. So we bought wholesale. And all of us was country boys who could work. And each one of us had a crew of other kids that were working for us. So some weeks we would make $600 in 1971. That was a lot of money for a 15-year-old, 16-year-old then. So I got all this money rolling in, so I went and got me a ride. Got me a fancy car. So I took this GTO. It had a 1969 Judge Engine in it with dual line, an 850 dual line Harley. Boy, and that thing would go anytime these cars they got now, you know, you'd be like, those are manufactured cars. Yeah, but we made our own hot rod. And this thing would sound like a freight train when it was running, man. And everybody liked the sound of them heads. And then we rolled back down in the country. Boy, them women had to hide their daughters because, man, every girl wanted to ride in that hot rod. So, and all these ladies trusted me with their daughters because this is Deacon Daly's daughter and Sister Daly's son. So, this is a fine boy. You know, for the most part, they were right. But we were typical boys. So, we had a lot of fun just to say the least. You know, I didn't get into a lot of fights and crazy stuff, just like girls in basketball and football. Those were my only vices. Played a lot of sports. But we always knew that a little alcohol mixed with a little something would get the girls going. So we figured out then that, okay, we have the solution. So that led to, you know, and at that time, at 16, I could actually go in the liquor store. Either Alabama didn't care about the law, or I looked like I was 21. So I began to start purchasing booze for my dad. And he would send me to Camden, that's where it was, Wilcox County. I never will forget, the first state store, they called it. ABC store in Alabama, you know, Alabama Beverage Control. They wasn't controlling shit because I was 16 years old. I was 16 years old and I'm legally buying booze without any ID. So I hate to bust them out like that, but I hope it don't incriminate us. But that was kind of the norm then. You know, I guess we had a little freedom and we kind of like made our own laws down there. But then it went from Hoppengator to like Southern Comfort. I don't know if you all know anything about Southern Comfort. But then I think one time we messed around and got some wild turkey. Oh my God. Woo! That's the worst headache I ever had. I never recommended wild turkey. I'm sorry. If you all were promoting wild turkey, I'm sorry. But I couldn't get a wild turkey. So, because wild turkey would actually knock you on your butt. See, I wasn't trying to get drunk. I was just trying to have fun. You know, I didn't believe in just losing control. Once again, I'm a control freak. So, drinking, conflict, it was control and alcohol was a dilemma. So when I mixed those two, then I had a paradoxically potentially explosive situation. So I knew what alcohol did to me. And why I didn't like alcohol was because when you consume a certain amount of alcohol, your ability seemed to lessen or vanish to a degree. I don't know what y'all call it, but I don't think you have any control. And it impacted my behavior. So, and that was one part of the drinking experience that I did not like. I didn't like the way alcohol made me behave. Because you went from a sound thinking person to this person out of control, making poor decisions and judgments. You know, that's what we'll get to in the fifth step. But a lot of those issues that you face, you know, it comes once you become inebriated. And that's where a lot of we would be fine people if we didn't have that challenge. And it has caused a lot of harm to us. And it made me somebody that I didn't like. So I get further into that as we get a little further along the way in this program, or this talk tonight, which is the program. That's where it all come from. So by the 12th, 11th grade, I was class president for 6 years. I had been class president so long. To my senior year, I said, I'm tired of being class president. I'm going to resign. So I decided I had other things to do now. I'm a senior. So I got to explore and experiment with a lot of these senior things. But I did well. I was on the first biracial committee. That's something that I'm proud of about being in that little town. Because of the integration, they had a biracial committee. So when black students and white students came together to work out programs that would help the race relationship. This was in the early 70s, so we was coming out of the 60s, and we were still in the South. So it was a lot of things going on still. I was only 50 miles from Selma, and on that Bloody Sunday, my brothers and cousins, a lot of them went to that march. But Mama wasn't having me going, because I was only like 10 or something like that. But I was actively involved with things, and you know, in high school. By then, I was always an entrepreneur. So now I was selling papers. I mean, I sold anything that people would buy. I sold grit papers. Now you tell me the connection between a black kid in this little southern town selling grit paper. And grit paper was a northern paper, but I was good enough. I had everybody buying grit papers. So I sold berries. I had all kinds of clients, black, white. Everybody wanted plums and berries. So I was an entrepreneur. I always had money, is what I'm saying. Actually, I started in the limousine business when I was in high school, because I had two cars, and a lot of these athletes didn't have any way home after practice. So that was plenty drinking money. That was plenty beer money. You know, every time the girl got in the car, oh, what you got to drink? Something for you, honey. Or whatever you So these, you know, it was all in good taste, you know, but you know, we had our agenda. So, that was because I had cash. I had money. I didn't have to ask Mama and Daddy for money every time. I had two cars. You know, I had to take care of these things. So during my senior year, there were a lot of good things that we did. Our basketball team, we went to the state tournament that year. There was an interesting story between me and my coach. When I was in ninth grade, I was on a team that was undefeated, our junior team. And he had a tradition of picking all the junior players to put them on the varsity team. But he never would let the junior players play. So this was one of those strict coaches, and nobody rebelled, Coach Avery. So I taught five of my buddies that were on that junior team to rebel against him. And he took it personal. So from the ninth grade until the 12th grade, he wouldn't let me play varsity basketball. But God works in mysterious ways. So three of the players quit the varsity team. So Coach came to me, and he had this deep voice. "I want to talk to you, baby." I said, "Okay, Coach, what's going on? I need you. So I was put on that varsity team. I mean, I wanted to be on the varsity team. It was disappointing not to be on that varsity team. Not only on the varsity team, I'm starting, and I'm one of the captains on this team. And we went to the state tournament, went to the second round. The year before, we had won the state. And this coach was very instrumental in my development, because before this basketball incident, he made me the class supervisor. He and I had a great relationship, but he never would let me play basketball. Then I had another professor. Some kind of way, you're going to see how I had these relationships with these professors. Now, this one professor named Solicitor Milliner, he let us party at his house. And he always had parties. In high school, back, if that was a law then, they would have been locked up, man. Because all these youngsters, underage kids, were drinking and partying at our math teacher's house. I guess he felt that, well, at least I can watch over them and see after them. But I always end up friends with these drinking professors. So now about to graduate, left there in the 70s, early 70s. Now I'm headed to Tuskegee. Before that, I went to Cleveland for the summer. Went to Chicago. Went to Cleveland, but left Cleveland and went to Chicago. So Chicago was, to me, a little faster than Cleveland. And Chicago had a lot going on. And Chicago cops were pretty wild. But I remember as soon as we got to Chicago, we were downtown on State Street. And the cop pulled us over. And I didn't know my cousin had an ounce of marijuana. And all cops are not bad. So whoever said that, they're lying. All cops ain't bad. These cops say, "What the hell is this?" So he was like, "Oh no, that's you." So the cops said, "I'll tell you what. I'm going to pull this crap out and y'all get the hell out down here." Boy, he's talking about somebody happy, because I could imagine calling my mama. Talking about I'm downtown in Cook County Jail. So that was the beginning of my summer in Chicago. But Chicago was cool because I had other cousins there in Chicago already in other activities now. They had a few side dishes to go along with all these fancy drinks. So that was my first introduction to what you call a little blow. So you were supposed to be sophisticated if you had a little blow. And all the girls really like that candy. So the candy man is here. So we were. So now we got money. I'm working. I'm making money. Having fun in Chicago. Now I got to get out of Chicago. I got to get back to Alabama to start college at the famous Tuskegee. It was Tuskegee Institute then, but it's now Tuskegee University. A great historic Tuskegee. So that was quite an experience at Tuskegee. You know, that was a whole lot of partying at Tuskegee. There was this bench they called the ignorant bench, and it really was ignorant because all these guys with that never went to class stayed on the ignorant bench. And I don't know why they called it the ignorant bench, because they were too damn stupid to go to class. So, but anyway, everybody had to sit on the ignorant bench. You couldn't be authentic Tuskegee if you didn't sit on the ignorant bench. So that's how you were like orientated to school. So now I'm at Tuskegee. I'm doing pretty good. And our dormitory was one of the old dormitories, and we were sort of isolated from the rest of the campus. So every night there was a party in that dormitory. And these guys were real, they were real drinkers, man. They had bottles of vodka, gallons of gin, all types of liquor was in this dormitory. So I started to gravitate to a little stronger drink. So now we drinking rum, vodka, and all these heavy alcoholic drinks. But I was still doing my work. It didn't interfere with my college that year. But it was kind of funny when I got home, they sent this little notice that you need to see the academic dean. So I was like, I wonder why. I did pretty good, I thought. So I ended up on probation the first semester. So the second semester I had to anchor down. So I pulled this grade point up in the second semester, but it still wasn't where I wanted to be. So while I was in Chicago that summer, they sent the grades home to my parents. And one of my brothers, who was a big shot minister, he read the grades and then said that, well, you are on academic probation because of what I had done that first year. So now I got to anchor down. So I get serious, and the next semester I had a 3.5, so things started to click. Now I got a handle on how to survive at this college level, and I started to get involved with activities, became the student coordinator, and I met another professor. And this professor was a very learned guy, graduated from Tuskegee with like a 4-point average, and then went to Notre Dame Law School and excelled, and came back to teach at Tuskegee. And he had a dysfunctional marriage, I think, because he was at my house every night. I mean, we cooked and we drank. Then I would be like, dude, I got to go to your class at 8 o'clock in the morning. You need to go home. So, and one thing about it, this guy never gave me a break. I sort of had a resentment against his ass for that. I was like, this guy is interfering with my study time, and then he won't give me a break. But I appreciated him for not doing that, because it made me really appreciate earning your wages. But I got through Tuskegee. I had a lot of fun. One of my friends started playing pro basketball here in Atlanta. So I'm coming to Atlanta on the weekend, and I'm hanging out with the big boys, and there's plenty of everything at this level now. There wasn't no shortage of anything. There was plenty of money, plenty of drugs, plenty of girls, plenty of anything you wanted. Plenty of cars, plenty of clothes. So now you could go down that fast lane and really look like you belong. You know, so I experienced a lot of stuff during that period. But thank God that my higher power looked out for me, and I was able to make it through. And after I graduated from Tuskegee, I went to Chicago again. So now I'm in Chicago in 1977. I don't really want a job. So now, my uncle worked with the Lutheran Church, the Missouri Synod, and he said, I might have a deal for you. I said, what's that? He said, I think they'll pay you to go to school. I was like, that sounds pretty good to me. So I left Chicago and went to Fort Wayne, Indiana, Concordia Lutheran Seminary. So now I'm in Fort Wayne. They paying me about $900 a month, all the room and board, tuitions are paid. So I got a lot of cash. So already had ties with Chicago, so I'm able to go to Chicago. I know where all the spots are. I got all the clothes. I got all the connection. So now I can really play this game. So again, I met another professor. This professor was a learned guy, Kurt Marcos from Moscow. And he was real Russian. We drank straight vodka. And we eat those sausages. So, can you boys think y'all can hang out with me? I said, I don't know, Dr. Marcos, but if you insist, well, I'll be by tonight about 10 o'clock. And man, I hate to see Kurt Marcos coming, man, with a filth of vodka and these Russian sausages. And he wanted you to drink that straight vodka. like, oh God, we're not alcoholics, Dr. Marcos. I think you're an alcoholic, but we'll step a little bit to help you out. And this man had written about 15 books. He'd been in Cambridge, Oxford, Yale, all these fine institutions. I mean, a learned man. But that tells you alcohol don't discriminate. It don't care nothing about your degree. Alcohol is the master. So, it will become friends with you and change your life. And it will destroy your life. So, I was paying attention to this usage of alcohol and all these illicit, primarily cocaine. Let's keep it simple, keep it real for those that didn't experience that. Like Bill Wilson them called the alcoholics rummies. But down south we call them drunks. That's what they were. So we were on a path there. And now I only needed 2 years to complete this program. So I'm about finished with this program. Learned a lot of stuff. Systematic theology, church history, church business, everything. I was equipped to take over this Lutheran parish. But I knew I didn't want to be a parish minister. You know, little did I know, I would be a fisherman of men. I would be out here doing service work, carrying a message. You never know how God is going to use you. So don't give up on God, because He will help you achieve your dream and your goal. So I just thought I'd throw a little bit of that seminary training on you there. Just, but we won't go too far away because Rusty is back there. Yeah. But there were so many good things that I used today in my recovery that I learned from that training. And it helps me relate to people. It, you know, they talk about empathy and sympathy for people and how to deal with people in grief when the family has lost loved ones, and how you prepare a mother for a deceased child. All these things we're trained to do. And it helps me now talk to sponsees and my family people, because two of my brothers were ministers and both of them had their doctorate theology. And they went the way of the Baptist, traditional Baptist church. But I went to the Lutheran seminary. One thing I liked about AA is that AA was able to stay together. The unity in AA kept AA together. But John Calvin broke away from the church. Martin Luther broke away from the church. Several, the United Methodists and the Methodists broke away. They all split. The Lutherans split. There were always problems in those churches with different ideologies and different perspectives. But one thing about this program, AA unity has survived for 85 years. So I think we all should give AA a hand, because we have survived 88 years and we're still going. And, you know, I've done this a number of times. And I think I've gotten through it tonight without cursing. And I was determined to do that tonight without cursing. And I feel pretty good that I didn't have to. You see, you guys are really good. I didn't have to use one curse word. That's why you all are a fine group. Did I use one? I lied. Sorry. But is that clock right?
Yes.
We were just about. Yeah, you mean I got time if y'all do. No, I'm just kidding. But I'm going to hasten on here to tell you. So, I hit a wall when I left Chicago, Indiana, came here in 1979. And I got into the music business, started my own production company. So that was a fascinating business. But my usage had gotten a little out of hand. And the more I did these abstract drugs, the more I drank. So I think my tolerance level got pretty strong with alcohol, and then I didn't realize that. And like I said earlier, it impacted my behavior and my thinking. So it led me to some places I didn't want to go and I didn't like. So it caused me to have to face some of the consequence. And I wished I had time to get off into that. But you know the story. We all got our own story. Just use your story for that part, okay? Just fill in the blank with you. I'm sure you all are not all angels up in here. Now, don't try to act like that tonight. So, we all know what alcohol, and we all know we got our own story, and we blazed our own trail. But look at what God has done for you, me, and all the rest of y'all. The one thing about it is you don't ever have to drink a drug again. I did some things. I got into those steps. And I'm going to tell you that is the most powerful thing that I... And I read a lot of books by a lot of smart, great people. But that's some of the best literary, simple 200 words that I ever laid eyes on. The only problem with it was I got a resentment when I first saw it. Because I should have been able to figure out that shit. I couldn't do it, and I didn't do it. So that's why I said, Bill Wilson, get into the history of it. Get excited about this program. If you're a newcomer, don't worry about it if you don't know. I got excited when I first heard 3, 7, and 11. Man, I couldn't wait to be able to say that shit. Excuse that language, but that's what it meant to me then. 3, 7, and 11. I say 3, 7, and 11 is important because that's what God is doing for you. That's where it all starts, at that third step. And when you get to the fifth step, after you've looked at all your stuff, I mean, looked at it now. Not take it out on the porch and let it sit there and look at it. I'm talking about get rid of it. You know, when you flush, you don't reach down and try to, you know what I'm talking about. You have to let that shit go. That's what the fourth step is. When they say clean house, that's what it is. So if any of you struggling with it, trust me, this works. And keep coming back. That's why we say keep coming back. Because nobody measure how many times you've been in and out of this door. Hopefully you don't have to come back but one time. But I wish I had more time because I really love this program. And I try to carry this message. There's a lot of stories that I could tell you about. But we only got 45 minutes. So, you know, that's the one thing. And I appreciate you. And I want to read one thing before I go. Oh, you've been late before. Ain't that right? You know, I come from a Baptist church. We didn't get out on time. Only the Lutherans got out on time. And one thing I learned in the seminary, if the Lutherans taught me that if it offends a Southerner to drink in front of them, just don't drink in front of him. Hey, we were talking about Southern preachers there. Not you all. Your drinking days are over, right? Right? Some of y'all, I didn't hear you.
Come on, I know you heard me. Your drinking days are over, right?
Some of y'all are a little shaky on that. Don't forget, if you're planning to slip, let me know how that spill not vodka tastes. For the past few weeks, we have been asking ourselves some searching questions. We have not been able to answer them all we would like. But on the right answer to these questions will depend the usefulness and the effectiveness of our lives, and to some extent the usefulness and effectiveness of the whole AA movement. It all boils down to this. I owe a deep debt to AA and to the grace of God. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, Moses. That was beautiful.
If the river keep arising, water gonna overflow. If that river keep arising, flood water gonna overflow. Just like that old river, baby, it's my time to go. Banks gonna overrun, everything's torn apart. The banks gonna overrun, everything's torn apart. Done.